Kardashian, who is exactly as terrible in this movie as you would expect. There were high hopes for this film, born of the optimism that finally, after years of writing, directing, and producing plays, screenplays, and television scripts, Perry might finally move beyond the mediocrity so much of his work is mired in. Certainly, Temptation is one of the most polished of Perry's films, but that is not saying much. The movie is still hampered by uneven acting, strange directorial choices, e.g. Vanessa Williams' French accent, a weak screenplay, and some rather sloppy editing. At one point, Lance Gross, as Bryce, hoarsely shouts, "Judith!" over and over. During the screening I attended, every single person began laughing loudly. It was not meant to be a humorous moment. It is saying something that these are the least of Temptation's worries. When the movie opens, a marriage counselor chooses to ignore professional standards and tells a client contemplating infidelity about her own sister. Judith fell in love with her husband, Bryce, when they were mere children, married very young, and ended up in Washington, D.C. She works as a counselor for a high-end dating service, while Bryce is a pharmacist for a small drugstore. They have a modest apartment and a modest but good relationship. We're supposed to believe Judith is dissatisfied, though her dissatisfaction is never really expressed, save for when Judith is dismayed by things like her husband forgetting her birthday for the second year in a row, or when she balks at Bryce suggesting it will be 10 or 15 years before she can start her own counseling practice. Enter Harley, a handsome billionaire in talks to partner with Janice, Judith's boss. This is the flimsiest of pretenses, and Perry never bothers to make this plot even a little plausible. Judith and Harley's attraction is palpable, and thus begins a seduction that Judith rebuffs for quite some time because she is married and a good girl. The seduction includes innuendo, flowers, and meaningful staring. This is a morality play, after all. Eventually, Harley flies Judith to New Orleans for business on his private jet, always the gateway to sin, and they enjoy the city, oblivious to her marital obligations. On the return flight, despite Judith openly saying no to Harley's sexual advances and fighting him off, the couple engages in what looks a lot like rape, but is thinly disguised as sex. This is the beginning of Judith's end. This is the climax of Perry's morality tale. Woman, thou art fallen. By the end of Temptation, Judith has been punished and severely. She descends into a so-called hell on earth, dressing provocatively, drinking too much, quitting her job, and disrespecting her mother, her marriage, and herself. She is violently beaten by Harley, only to be rescued by Bryce, the good man, the steady man. Most egregiously, Judith contracts HIV and ends up single, a broken woman limping to church while Bryce lives happily ever after with a beautiful new wife and young son. He is, of course, still his ex-wife's pharmacist. There are so many appalling elements to how this sordid morality tale plays out. There are so many appalling messages about sexuality, consent, the ways men and women interact, ambition, happiness, and HIV. As with most of Perry's movies, good black men who are content with their stations are the moral compasses by which we should all set our true north. Perry would have you believe the road to hell is paved with personal and professional happiness. Ambition is dangerous and not to be trusted, especially in a woman. Perry has a finely honed obsession with fetishizing the working class, which in and of itself is not a problem and could almost be admired. It's that his motives are disingenuous. It's that Perry denigrates one thing in order to elevate another instead of suggesting that there is pride to be had in being working class But that aspiring toward anything more isn't inherently evil. That the wealthy are regularly demonized in Perry films is quite the irony, given the enormous wealth Perry has amassed from a largely working-class audience. Time and again, Perry's movies follow a pathological formula, where truth, salvation, and humility will be found by returning to working-class roots. In Diary of a Mad Black Woman, a wealthy lawyer, Charles, throws Helen, his wife of 18 years, out on the street. She learns to stand on her own, with the help of her working-class family. She slowly falls in love with Orlando, a working-class man. Because Perry loves to punish his characters to make a point, Charles is shot in the back by an angry client and only has Helen to turn to because his mistress has abandoned him. Through Helen's kindness and the goodness of God, Charles learns to walk again, and though he wants to reconcile with his wife, she divorces him and runs to Orlando. The working-class man triumphs over all. In The Family That Prays, ambitious Andrea desperately wants more out of life than she has with her construction worker husband. She has an affair with her wealthy boss, William, enjoying all the trappings of both her own success and her infidelity. There are lots of machinations involving a family business and the like. In the end, Andrea ends up poor, alone with her son in an apartment while her now ex-husband thrives. Yet again, the working-class hero rises. Good Deeds, one of Perry's more recent films, follows wealthy Wesley Deeds, who has always done what is right and expected of him. When he meets Lindsay, a down-on-her-luck single mother who cleans his building, he begins to realize he wants more out of life. Instead of relying on the magical Negro trope seen in many movies, see The Help, Perry uses the magical sassy maid trope to his advantage. To round things out, Wesley's wealthy mother is kind of evil and his wealthy brother is a resentful alcoholic, but Wesley is saved from the perils of wealth by quitting his job so he can go find himself, accompanied by Lindsay and her daughter, of course, in Africa. Perry is not only intensely concerned with class. Sexuality should be chaste and contained if you are a woman. Trying new sexual moves with your husband is unbecoming, but if you are a man, you should take whatever it is you want from a woman. Perry would have you believe a just punishment for infidelity and human frailty is HIV. He is gleefully trading on ignorance because he is a small man with a limited imagination. Part of the pleasure of the movies is stepping away from reality. One of Perry's most significant problems, however, is how he completely reconstructs reality to suit his purposes in ways that are utterly lacking in artistic merit. Many of the choices he makes in Temptation are blatantly contradicted by factual reality. People are marrying later than ever before, so we have to suspend our disbelief as Perry constructs this fairy tale that Judith and Bryce would meet as young children, stay in love, marry as teenagers, and go on to complete both undergraduate and graduate educations. In a study of first marriages as part of the 2006 to 2010 National Survey of Family Growth, researchers found that the median age for a first marriage is 25.8 for women and 28.3 for men. Black women had the lowest probability of being in a first marriage by the age of 25. Women with a bachelor's degree were also less likely to be in a first marriage by the age of 25. But let's suspend our disbelief just enough to imagine this young couple married and happily so. Perry has also set Temptation in a world where divorce is the exception rather than the rule. The reality is that marriages end, and often. The statistics for marital longevity are not on Judith and Bryce's side, so the idea that Judith is a sinner among sinners for wanting more from her marriage or wanting out of her marriage is absurd. Then there is this matter of so callously dealing with HIV as if we are still in the 1980s, full of profound ignorance about the disease. Perry shamelessly exploits HIV for the sake of his very narrow and subjective morality when HIV disproportionately affects black women who make up so much of his core audience. The disservice he does to this audience is hard to stomach. According to the Centers for Disease Control, the rate of new HIV infections is 20 times higher for black women than white women. An estimated 1 in 32 black African American women will be diagnosed with HIV infection in her lifetime, compared with 1 in 106 Hispanic Latino women and 1 in 526 white women. These are staggering statistics. Dealing with HIV prevention, treatment, and the stigma surrounding HIV are important issues for the black community. Issues deserving of both critical and creative attention. That attention should be handled ethically and with human decency. Concepts with which Tyler Perry seems to have no familiarity. His oeuvre has given me little confidence that Perry can handle any part of the human experience. Of course, also according to the Centers for Disease Control, HIV prevalence rates are inversely related to annual household income in urban poverty areas. The likelihood of a woman in Judith and Bryce's demographic contracting HIV is not very. Statistics show that the more educated people are and the more money they make, the less likely they are to contract HIV. As he so often does, Tyler Perry wants to have it every which way but right. And a high cost is being exacted so this man can get exactly what he wants. I attended a press screening of People's with a predominantly black crowd. It was the first time I'd seen a Tyler Perry production with his target audience. An hour before the screening, the line snaked all the way out the theater and into the auxiliary parking lot. I'd guess more than 100 people were turned away, and they were none too pleased, so eager were they to get a sneak peek at Perry's latest project. Those who did get in were vocally appreciative throughout. However troubling Perry's messages, however poorly written, directed, and produced his movies might be, he gives black people a chance to see some version of themselves on the big and small screens. For better or worse, he is the oasis in a cultural desert of black entertainment. People's was written and directed by a black woman, Tina Gordon Chisholm, who also wrote the winning Drumline, which starred Nick Cannon and Zoe Saldana. People's has an even better cast, including Craig Robinson, Kerry Washington, David Alan Greer, S. Epatha Murkerson, Diane Carroll, and Melvin Van Peebles. Robinson plays Wade Walker, an affable man who surprises his live-in lawyer girlfriend, Grace Peoples, Washington, at her family compound in Sag Harbor, only to learn her family doesn't even know he exists. Hijinks ensue as a family normally hell-bent on keeping up appearances and pleasing the patriarch, Grace's father, federal judge Virgil Peoples, Greer, learns to be more honest with one another about who they each really are. Peoples is a pretty good movie, even if we've all seen it before. It's basically Meet the Parents. It is not a great movie, mind you, like many of Perry's own movies. The talented cast is forced into roles that are written without much substance. But they make the very best of the material and keep us entertained from beginning to end. Chisholm's direction is assured. Though she hasn't written great characters, Chisholm does make sly jokes that audiences familiar with black culture are sure to enjoy, shrewdly sending up black fraternities, for instance. I had hoped that Peoples would help push Tyler Perry to become an incubator of black talent. The movie made me want to see more from Chisholm as both a screenwriter and director. And I still hope this is a beginning of a vibrant career for her, and that Perry provides similar opportunities for other talented black artists. Sadly, Peoples bombed. I had high hopes for this movie, not because it was good, but because it was certainly as good as any other movie being released these days. In its opening week, the movie made only $4.6 million, while appearing in more than 2,000 theaters. The second week was even worse, with the movie bringing in only $2.1 million. Early May 2013 was perhaps a bad time for a movie like People's to be released, what with all the early summer blockbusters like Iron Man 3, The Great Gatsby, and Star Trek Into Darkness being released around the same time. Still, the movie should have done better. At the very least, it should have gotten a boost as counter-programming to the explosive 3D and CGI-enhanced pomposity of summer movies. Audiences were not swayed by the imprimatur of Tyler Perry Presents. This box office failure implies that moviegoers wanted the high drama and heavy-handed messages Perry normally offers his audience, or they wanted the caricature of Madea to make them laugh. All of this got me thinking again about what exactly Perry is up to and why he's so popular. I have to consider the possibility that Tyler Perry movies are successful because of their moralism and their sneering at women, not in spite of them. It's a bitter pill to swallow. He knows his audience and gives them exactly what they want and what they have come to expect. When Perry doesn't give his audience what they want, caricatures of black men and women and broad moral messages, well, the box office doesn't lie. This is more complex an issue, though, than most critical discourse about Perry implies. Yes, Tyler Perry is a deeply problematic figure in entertainment for so many reasons, but he also gives his audience some of what they so very much need. As Todd Gilchrist notes for Movies.com, he uncovers and highlights real, honest moments of human interaction in a way that almost no other filmmaker is doing today. Maybe I continue watching Perry's films because I too see a glimmer of these real, honest moments. Or I am stubbornly clinging to the hope that someday he might live up to his potential and his responsibility to create good art for black people, however unreasonable that responsibility might be. I am eager to see more diverse experiences represented in modern entertainment. It is bittersweet that something is better than nothing, even if the something we have is hardly anything at all. The Last Day of a Young Black Man. 3 hours before the advance screening of Fruitvale Station I attended in Chicago, a line of eager fans stretched through the Cineplex. Many were dressed up, hair done right, faces beat, that is, their makeup was applied impeccably. Writer and director Ryan Coogler and stars Octavia Spencer and Michael B. Jordan were on hand for a talkback after the screening. The Reverend Jesse Jackson introduced the actors and the drama, which won the 2013 Grand Jury Prize at Sundance, referring to the movie's subject matter as Trayvon Martin in real time, and leading a vigorous call and response. Contemporary black film is not nearly as robust as it should be. When movies by a promising black writer like Coogler's Fruitvale Station premiere, black audiences wonder if finally they might enjoy a movie that is well written, acted, directed, and produced. Of course, this is the holy grail of all cinema, but it seems particularly unreachable in much of what black cinema has to offer. Broadly speaking, if contemporary black cinema were divided into categories, we'd have raunchy comedies like Soul Plane, the feel-good family films frequented by Eddie Murphy and Ice Cube, the awareness-raising films that tackle major race-related issues, and, of course, the work of Tyler Perry. Most black movies, for better or worse, carry a burden of expectation, having to be everything to everyone, because we have so little to choose from. Suffice it to say, a movie about a notorious incident of police brutality like Fruitvale Station enters an already fraught conversation. On New Year's Day in 2009, Bay Area Rapid Transit, BART, police officer Johannes Messerly working at the BART station in Oakland's heavily Latino Fruitvale district, shot Oscar Grant, a young black man returning to Oakland after celebrating with friends in San Francisco, in the back. Earlier that night, BART police had responded to reports of a fight by removing Grant and several of his friends from the train. Accounts of what happened next differ, but matters escalated quickly. Bystanders took a number of videos and images of the incident, and soon these artifacts of Grant's death went viral. Oakland residents held a vigil and rioted, releasing a long simmering rage over the plight of young black men in the city. Protests, some violent, would continue for more than a year. 4 years later, digital traces of Grant's death linger across the internet, continuing to bear witness. Fruitvale Station begins with Oscar, Michael B. Jordan, and his girlfriend, Sophina, Melanie Diaz, talking about their New Year's resolutions. Then the film jumps to 2:15 a.m. in the nearly empty station. Oscar and a group of his friends are seated on the ground. Officers surround them, both the young men and the police shouting. The footage from a cell phone is shaky and grainy, but there is no ambiguity about what is taking place. The rest of the movie chronicles the events leading up to that moment. Oscar is shown as a charming young man, with a troubled past who is finally on the right path. After two stints in prison for drug dealing, he is working to reconnect with Sophina. He dotingly cares for his daughter, Tatiana, and strives to be a good son to his mother, Wanda Octavia Spencer. A movie about limited options for young inner-city black men, Fruitvale also explores the multiple identities many of these men must adopt. Oscar is a master of code switching. The man he is with his mother is different from the man he is with his girlfriend and child, with his friends, or in prison. As director Coogler, who is from the Bay Area, notes, oftentimes you've got to be different people just to stay alive. When Oscar picks Tatiana up from daycare, they race back to the car, their bodies so full of joy it's like they're trying to outrun the feeling. Actor Michael B. Jordan, best known as Wallace, the 16-year-old dealer from The Wire, and Vince, the high school quarterback from Friday Night Lights, expresses that joy from his face to the kick of his heels. In scenes with Diaz, Jordan brings out the raw appeal of a young man in his prime. Slow drawls, sexy smiles, toned body. He also expresses openness and vulnerability when Oscar confesses to Sophina that he has lost his job and when, in prison, he begs his mother not to leave him alone. As Wanda, Octavia Spencer is the movie's moral center. She embodies nurturing, tough love and the small ways a mother never lets go. She chides Oscar for driving and talking on his cell phone, urging him to take the train home so he doesn't drink and drive. In a powerful flashback, Wanda visits Oscar in prison. He's in his uniform, thrilled to see a familiar face. Wanda is loving but weary, trying to hang on to what normalcy she can. During her visit, Oscar gets drawn into a verbal altercation with another inmate, revealing the aggressive, defiant man he can be when pushed. Wanda tries to calm him, but it's too much, how he has to straddle two worlds, and when he sits back down, his body is coiled with frustration. Wanda tells Oscar she won't be coming back to see him. Spencer's handling of the moment, with quiet control and resolve and no hysterics, is heartbreaking. There are moments of levity, like when Oscar has to buy a birthday card on behalf of his sister. Despite the sister's express instructions not to, he gets a card with white people on the front. Such moments not only humanize Oscar, they allow the audience to laugh, to exhale. We need that. Director Coogler had only the length of a movie, 90 minutes in this case, to give us a sense of who Oscar Grant was. Someone to mourn when the end came. He conducted extensive research on Grant's whereabouts on that final day and overcame the family's apprehension to work closely with them. In a prophetic scene, Oscar comforts a bleeding dog hit by a car, whispering kind words so the animal won't die alone. When Oscar is at the grocery store buying crab for his mother, a young woman at the butcher counter wants to fry fish, but is unsure how. Oscar gets his grandma Bonnie on the phone to school her. On the streets of San Francisco after midnight, surrounded by revelers, Oscar and his friends convince a store owner closing shop to let their girlfriends and the pregnant wife of a couple they don't know use the restroom. The men enjoy the camaraderie of strangers, and we see Oscar plan for a future he will not be part of. At times, Coogler's choices verge on the sentimental, if not manipulative. His investment in Grant's story is palpable. There are indulgent directorial choices, like the superimposing of text messages and phone numbers on the screen when Oscar is using his cell phone. It is a testament to the movie's excellence that the flaws are in the details. Fruitvale Station could have been an angry movie, but Coogler has crafted an intimate, at times exuberant, portrait. This was a deliberate choice. Co-star Octavia Spencer said during the question-and-answer session after the screening, "Anger without action leads to riots. I didn't know if that was the best emotion to associate with this film." Still, it is hard to consider what made the movie possible without surrendering to some amount of rage. As Coogler notes, Grant's murder came at a time where people in Oakland were optimistic about race. In one night, that optimism was taken away. Oakland, the eighth largest city in California, is a particularly difficult place for young black men. According to a June 2011 report from the Oakland Unified School District's Office of African American Male Achievement, in Oakland, African American male students have the worst outcomes of any demographic group, despite improvements in some areas in recent years. The world beyond the school system provides little statistical solace. According to the NAACP, nearly 1 million of the 2.3 million Americans in prison are African American. Further racial disparities persist in the length of sentencing and the effect of incarceration after release. These institutional biases make it difficult to envision how young black men can succeed. Or, as Oscar seems to say in the movie, feeling defeated by a series of failures, "I'm tired. Thought I could start over fresh, but shit ain't working out." Year after year, we discuss these statistics and the impossibility of them. Year after year, we tell the same stories, using these statistics to show how shit ain't working out. Accurately conceiving of what young black men face when we talk about them as numbers, though, is difficult. Some statistics loom so pervasively they have become myths. For example, a commonly recited quote-unquote fact is that more black men end up in jail than attend college. Ivory A. Toldson, a professor at Howard University, refutes this statement, noting in a series on black education for The Root that today there are approximately 600,000 more black men in college than in jail, and the best research evidence suggests that the line was never true to begin with. Behind the statistics for black men in Oakland and across the United States are men who are being failed by society. These statistics, when offered without any kind of reflection, do little to advance the conversation. And when they go unquestioned, as Toldson suggests, they distort the conversation. It is in this context that Fruitvale Station works compellingly to treat Oscar Grant as a man. Forced to decide whether to sell drugs to support his family, Oscar makes what we hope is the right choice, throwing a large quantity of marijuana into the bay. He tries to get his job back at a local grocer after being fired. Not only are his options drastically limited, his learning curve is steep. There is little room for error. For some young black men, there is no room for error at all. Depicting this reality was Coogler's primary aim because, he says, We struggle with a mass loss of life in the Bay Area, and the root of these issues is a demonization of young black men. Contemporary black cinema will not end the demonization of young black men, but a movie like Fruitvale Station offers us a necessary insight into the consequences. When black movies fail at the box office, too often it becomes a race to see who will first say, "This is why we can't have nice things." Take the case of Red Tails, produced by George Lucas and directed by Anthony Hemingway, which only earned a bit less than $50 million domestically. In interviews at the time of the film's release, Lucas, having put his own money behind the project to ensure it would receive a wide launch, essentially insisted the movie-going public bore a responsibility to see the movie. In an interview with USA Today, Lucas said, "I realize that by accident, I've now put the black film community at risk with Red Tails, whose $58 million budget far exceeds typical all-black productions. I'm saying, if this doesn't work, there's a good chance you'll stay where you are for quite a while. It'll be harder for you guys to break out of that lower-budget mold." Self-important and grandiose as his statement is, Lucas also gets at a frustrating truth. Each time a black movie is made, it has to succeed or risk fallout for the movies that follow. Fruitvale Station, though, bodes well for both the commercial viability and the artistic promise of black film. Early box office returns were excellent. In its opening weekend, Fruitvale Station grossed $377,285 with a $53,898 per screen average, and the movie went on to gross more than $16 million domestically during its theatrical run. The quality of the movie itself offers the hope that a broader range of quality black movies might be made, and that we will see black people portrayed in more nuanced ways. Movies matter. But still, there is this painful reality. Each time Oscar says goodbye to his girlfriend or family in Fruitvale Station, he adds, "I love you." Coogler remarked that many young men in the inner city do this because every time we leave the house, we know we might not make it back. Such is an uncanny burden. There is also this. Oscar Grant was 22 years old when he was murdered. Johannes Messerli, after serving just 1 year of a 2-year sentence, was released from prison on June 13, 2011. When less is more. The internet tells me I'm supposed to love the television series Orange is the New Black. The show is reasonably well written, there's an interesting premise, and the cast is diverse. You can't blink without someone celebrating the show's diversity. Orange is the New Black is very, very diverse. Did you know? I should love Orange is the New Black for the same reason I should, but do not, love Red Tails, or The Butler, or 42. Here is popular culture about people who look like me. That's all I should need, right? Time and again, people of color are supposed to be grateful for scraps from the table. There's this strange implication that we should enjoy certain movies or television shows simply because they exist. The critical response has been overwhelmingly positive. Emily Nussbaum, the New Yorker's television critic, wrote, "Smart, salty, and outrageous, the series falls squarely in the tradition of graphic adult cable drama. Were you pitching it poolside in Beverly Hills, you might call it the love child of Oz and the L Word." The description is perfect. There's grit and heartache balanced by charm and the soapy, outrageous goodness of melodrama. Orange is the New Black also has impressive staying power in the cultural conversation, particularly given that the show streams exclusively on Netflix, a subscriber service. By the way, did you know this show is remarkably diverse? I put off watching Orange is the New Black because I read the memoir, which was good, and watching the show didn't feel necessary. I never felt a need to move from one episode to the next, and toward the end, getting through the season became a chore. There are undoubtedly merits. I've enjoyed getting to know some of the characters. Sexuality is addressed in interesting, often nuanced ways, at least for the imprisoned white women. There is an amazing Nicholson Baker reference that made word nerds around the world rejoice. How the women build community and seek connection offers a compelling observation about what people need to survive. Laverne Cox is unequivocally outstanding as Sophia Bursett, a transgender woman with a wife and son. This detail is exactly what makes Orange Is the New Black as good as it is infuriating. Bursett's story is original and refreshing. Cox and Tanya Wright, who plays Bursett's wife, Crystal, create beautifully acted scenes that are intimate, bittersweet, and honest. Their storyline is the one thing on this show that is genuinely unlike anything else on television. The one element that lives up to the hype. It is frustrating that Orange Is the New Black is not nearly as good as the rapturous reception suggests. Creator Jenji Kohan can't commit to excellence or mediocrity. Instead, she dances along the razor-sharp line between the two. So many opportunities for the show to be truly original and smart are missed by wide margins. There's a Haitian character, Miss Claudette, quite the rarity, but her accent is inconsistent, bizarre, and bears no resemblance to a Haitian accent. She doesn't even seem like a Haitian woman. Perhaps on this point I am biased because I am Haitian American. Another inmate, Crazy Eyes, is more caricature than character. She is fixated on Piper. Her infatuation is supposed to be funny because crazy people are, I guess, hilarious. To be fair, her character is more fully developed as the season unfolds, but the early going is rough. In one scene, Crazy Eyes pisses just outside of Piper's bunk, the whites of her crazy eyes shining in the dark. I laughed along because Crazy Eyes is entertaining, and the talented Uzo Aduba makes the most of the role. The pleasure, though, is guilt-ridden because I'm too aware of how cavalierly dignity is sacrificed for pleasure's sake. Through no fault of actor Taylor Schilling, Piper, the central character, is the least interesting, primarily because Orange Is the New Black is a lovingly crafted monument to white girl problems. Certainly, Piper suffers as she comes to terms with the reality of her incarceration. There are deeply affecting scenes illustrating her plight. She has a wry sensibility that translates well, and still, we cannot ignore how the show's diverse characters are planets orbiting Piper's sun. The women of color don't have the privilege of inhabiting their own solar systems. This is what we consider diversity these days. Orange Is the New Black is based on Piper Kerman's memoir. The source material concerns a privileged white woman serving a prison sentence. This show cannot be anything but what it is, and that's fine. Unfortunately, we will never see a similar show about a woman of color as a stranger in a strange land, bewildered by incarceration. We will never see someone dare to write against the dominant narrative about women of color and incarceration. There is also the grating sense that we should congratulate Kohan for making a good choice, a long overdue choice, instead of an easy choice. We should be grateful diverse actors finally have more opportunity to practice their craft, despite the fact that Orange Is the New Black is diverse in the shallowest, most tokenistic ways. In The Nation, Aura Bogado notes, "With very little exception, I saw wildly racist tropes. Black women who, aside from fanaticizing about fried chicken, are called monkeys and crazy eyes. A Boricua mother who connives with her daughter for the sexual attentions of a white prison guard. An Asian woman who never speaks. And a crazy Latina who tucks away in a bathroom stall to photograph her vagina." This is the famine from which we must imagine feast. I'm tired of feeling like I should be grateful when popular culture deigns to acknowledge the experiences of people who are not white, middle class, or wealthy and heterosexual. I'm tired of the extremes. So few movies or shows fall between those extremes, but thankfully the ones that do, The Game, Grey's Anatomy, and Scandal, Love and Basketball, The Best Man, Jumping the Broom, Peoples, and the like, are good, not always great, but well within reach. We need more. We need pop culture that demonstrates not only the ways people are different, but also the ways we are very much alike. In her review, Nussbaum also says the show is smarter and subtler about the entire range of female-female dynamics than almost anything on TV. She's right. The bar is so low for portrayals of people out of the mainstream that smarter and subtler seems like so much more than it actually is. Why are we still talking about Orange is the New Black? The conversation is a measure of how much we are forced to settle, or perhaps, how much we're willing to settle. Politics, gender, and race. The politics of respectability. When a black person behaves in a way that doesn't fit the dominant cultural idea of how a black person should be, there is all kinds of trouble. The authenticity of his or her blackness is immediately called into question. We should be black, but not too black. Neither too ratchet nor too bougie. There are all manner of unspoken rules of how a black person should think and act and behave, and the rules are ever changing. We hold all people to unspoken rules about who and how they should be, how they should think, and what they should say. We say we hate stereotypes, but take issue when people deviate from those stereotypes. Men don't cry. Feminists don't shave their legs. Southerners are racist. Everyone is, by virtue of being human, some kind of rule breaker. And my goodness, do we hate when the rules are broken. Black people often seem to be held to a particularly unreasonable standard. Prominent figures have a troubling habit of coming forward with maxims about how black people should be and behave. One such person is Bill Cosby. In an op-ed for the New York Post, Cosby identified apathy as one of the black community's biggest problems. If we just care enough about ourselves and our communities, we will reach a hallowed place where we will no longer suffer the effects of racism. Most of Cosby's commentary on race in recent years might be summarized as such. If we act right, we will finally be good enough for white people to love us. CNN anchor Don Lemon offered 5 suggestions for the black community to overcome racism. Black people should stop using the N-word. Black people should respect their communities by not littering. Black people should stay in school. Black people should have fewer children out of wedlock and, most inexplicably, young black men should pull their pants up. Lemon also offered anecdotal evidence that he rarely sees people litter in white communities. He then played on the assumption of homophobia, explaining, with regard to sagging pants, that, in fact, it comes from prison, when they take away belts from prisoners so they can't make a weapon. And then it evolved into which role each prisoner would have during male-on-male prison sex. Implicit in Lemon's argument was that the white heterosexual man is the cultural ideal toward which we should all aspire. Curious thinking from Lemon. Cosby, Lemon, and others who espouse similar ideas are, I would like to believe, coming from a good place. Their suggestions are on one level reasonable, mostly grounded in common sense, but these leaders traffic in respectability politics. The idea that if black or other marginalized people simply behave in culturally approved ways, if we mimic the dominant culture, it will be more difficult to suffer the effects of racism. Respectability politics completely overlook institutional racism and the ways in which the education system, the social welfare system, and the justice system only reinforce many of the problems the black community faces. We are having an ongoing and critical conversation about race in America. The question on many minds, the question that is certainly on my mind, is how do we prevent racial injustices from happening? How do we protect young black children? How do we overcome so many of the institutional barriers that exacerbate racism and poverty? It's a nice idea that we could simply follow a prescribed set of rules and make the world a better place for all. It's a nice idea that racism is a finite problem for which there is a finite solution, and that respectability, perhaps, could have saved all the people who have lost their lives to the effects of racism. But we don't live in that world, and it's dangerous to suggest that the targets of oppression are wholly responsible for ending that oppression. Respectability politics suggests that there's a way for us all to be model, red like white, citizens. We can always be better, but will we ever be ideal? Do we even want to be ideal, or is there a way for us to become more comfortably human? Take, for example, someone like Don Lemon. He is a black man, raised by a single mother, and now he is a successful news anchor for a major news network. His outlook seems driven by the notion that if he can make it, anyone can. This is the ethos espoused by people who believe in respectability politics. Because they have achieved success, because they have transcended, in some way, the effects of racism or other forms of discrimination, all people should be able to do the same. In truth, they have climbed a ladder and shattered a glass ceiling, but are seemingly uninterested in extending that ladder as far as it needs to reach so that others may climb. They are uninterested in providing a detailed blueprint for how they achieved their success. They are unwilling to consider that until the institutional problems are solved, no blueprint for success can possibly exist. For real progress to be made, leaders like Lemon and Cosby need to at least acknowledge reality. Respectability politics are not the answer to ending racism. Racism doesn't care about respectability, wealth, education, or status. Oprah Winfrey, one of the wealthiest people in the world, and certainly the wealthiest black woman in the world, openly discusses the racism she continues to encounter in her daily life. In July 2013, while in Zurich to attend Tina Turner's wedding, Winfrey was informed by a store clerk at the Trois Pommes boutique that the purse she was interested in was too expensive for her. "We don't need to cry for Oprah, prevented from buying an obscenely overpriced purse, but we can recognize the incident as one more reminder that racism is so pervasive and pernicious that we will never be respectable enough to outrun racism. Not here in the United States, not anywhere in the world. We must stop pointing to the exceptions, these bright shining stars who transcend circumstance. We must look to how we can best support the least among us, not spend all our time blindly revering and trying to mimic the greatest without demanding systemic change." In July 2013, President Obama made a historic speech about race. His remarks were by far the most explicit remarks the president has made on the subject. In addition to sharing his own experiences with racism, he offered suggestions about how we might improve race relations in the United States. Ending racial profiling, re-examining state and local laws that might contribute to tragedies like Trayvon Martin's murder, and finding more effective ways to support black boys. These suggestions are a bit vague, and black girls seem to be forgotten as if they too don't need support. But at least Obama's ideas place the responsibility for change on all of us. We are, after all, supposed to be one nation, indivisible. Only if we act as such might we begin to truly effect change. When Twitter does what journalism cannot. On Tuesday, June 25, 2013, Texas State Senator Wendy Davis stood for nearly 13 hours without food or drink, without rest, without leaning, without the ability to use the restroom, to filibuster Senate Bill 5, SB 5, a legislative measure that would have closed 37 of the 42 abortion clinics in Texas, the largest state in the contiguous United States. Interested people from around the country, nay, the world, were able to watch this filibuster and the political maneuverings of those who tried to stop it via a live stream on YouTube, one watched at times by more than 180,000 people. The filibuster was a gripping spectacle that kept me rapt for hours. On Twitter, people were able to offer support, however symbolic, for Senator Davis's efforts. There was a sense of community. For some levity, I couldn't help but remark on Senator Davis's flawless hair, several hours into her ferocious stand. Near midnight, after some intense and partisan efforts to derail Senator Davis's efforts, the impassioned crowd in the gallery began shouting and cheering, letting the senator know she did not stand alone. It was a sound of women fighting for their reproductive freedom in the only way they could, with their voices. I will never forget that sound. It awoke something in me I hadn't realized had gone dormant. And why were so many of us watching this amazing set of events happen on a YouTube stream? Because none of the major news networks, not one, carried or covered the last hours of the filibuster. The gap between old and new media yawned ever wider. That, however, is not where this story begins. The reason I knew anything about what was going on in Texas was thanks to the efforts and boundless energy of Jessica W. Luther, at SCATX, a Texas activist who shared information about SB 5 for weeks. I don't know her personally, but we became connected online. I'll be honest, at first I was completely clueless about what was happening in Texas. At times I thought, I do not have the energy to care about this. Luther was so committed though and so full of passion and good information that I started to care. I started to pay attention. I read the articles and commentaries she shared and began to understand what was at stake, not just for women in Texas, but for all American women. I was reminded that change sometimes does begin with one person who raises her voice. And there I was, watching a YouTube live feed of a state Senate filibuster, something I never thought I would do. Social media is a curious thing. On the one hand, it offers an endless parade of ephemera from the daily lives of friends, family, and strangers. Discussions of a fondness for yogurt. A picture of a barista's decoration in latte foam. Descriptions of excellent meals, pictures of pets and small children, or maybe an abandoned easy chair on a crowded street corner. There's all manner of self-promotion and relentless affirmation. There are knee-jerk, ill-informed reactions to, well, everything. The abundance of triviality is as hypnotic as it is repulsive. But there are times when social media is anything but trivial. During Hurricane Sandy, social media allowed public officials along the Eastern Corridor to disseminate information about available resources and evacuation routes, and provide updates on the storm. Social media allowed community members to offer information and assistance and human connection through small, grassroots networks. Certainly, there were flies in the ointment as people of questionable moral stability spread rumors and began, with astonishing speed, to develop fraudulent schemes. But for the most part, social media was used to accomplish some good. I cannot think of a significant event in recent memory I did not first learn about via Twitter. The midnight shootings in Aurora, Colorado. The massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary. the uprisings across the Middle East during the Arab Spring, the activities of the Occupy movement, the results of the 2012 presidential election, the shooting of Trayvon Martin and ensuing debacle, the fertilizer plant explosion in West Texas, the bombings at the Boston Marathon. When these major news stories are breaking, there's always a significant difference between what's being shared via social media and what major news outlets are covering. That difference becomes more pronounced and more pathetic with each passing day. Good journalism takes time that social media, which advances at a breathtaking pace, rarely affords. Good journalists need to verify information before they can report it. They need this time because, in the best of all worlds, we're supposed to trust that they are offering us accurate, unbiased information. But even after they've applied the necessary rigor to their profession, journalists from major news outlets still seem like they can't keep up. Or perhaps it's that they won't keep up. Somehow, though, smaller journalism outlets managed to get the work done. The feed of Wendy Davis's filibuster was made possible because the Texas Tribune, a nonprofit news organization in Texas, was there from the start. On Tuesday, June 25th, Senator Wendy Davis stood and fought for reproductive freedom in her state, and the networks were largely silent. MSNBC offered some coverage earlier in the evening, but during the last few hours, the news networks, the 24-hour news networks created for this very purpose, were silent. They reported inaccurate information when they bothered to report at all. The next morning, CNN anchor Chris Cuomo referred to the efforts of Davis and the Texas men and women who held vigil with her as odd politics at work. And before that suggested, why not spend the time trying to compromise and figure out the bill in the first place? As if reproductive freedom is simply a matter of compromise. He was incompetent, a frustrating combination of dismissiveness and negligence. When journalism is working effectively, and it often is, I appreciate having journalists explain what I might not understand or know enough about. An internet connection does not make me or anyone an expert on culturally significant events. Smart journalistic perspective would have been useful to many people while Senator Davis spoke. Instead of being able to turn to news, though, people were on Twitter and elsewhere across the internet, researching parliamentary procedures of the Texas legislature, sharing the most significant moments of the night, and holding the Texas Republican senators accountable when they tried to break their own rules, even though they were in plain sight. Average people with internet connections did the work we used to trust major journalism outlets to do. Smart journalistic perspective was useful earlier on June 25th, when the Supreme Court, in an appalling 5-4 decision, struck down Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, essentially disenfranchising a significant number of Americans, voters of color, rural voters, elderly voters, and impoverished voters. It was useful to see what people were thinking about that decision across social networks, but it was even more useful to read and watch well-considered reporting about a topic I don't know much about. It was more useful to be informed than to assume the responsibility of having to inform. That same Supreme Court overturned the Defense of Marriage Act and dismissed California's Proposition 8 appeal, offering one step forward after innumerable steps back. Again, social networks were active, mostly with jubilation, or not, depending on whom you consort with. The Twitter discussions about DOMA also provide a useful reminder that the institution of marriage can and should be critiqued as we move forward with marriage equality. There were discussions about the implications for gay and lesbian couples in binational marriages and the financial benefits the wedding industry will reap from this decision. Social networking broadened the conversation. The news networks covered these decisions on marriage equality fairly robustly. Around the same time, they also covered George Zimmerman's trial for the murder of Trayvon Martin. The ongoing intrigue involving Edward Snowden and revelations about the NSA, and Paula Deen's damage control. There is no shortage of news, and there never has been. We live in a big, messy world. Social networks are